You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Nina Khachaturian. She is known for conceptual works that explore themes of mapping, translation, and public space. Her projects have been exhibited widely. She's represented by the Catherick Clark Gallery in San Francisco and is recently published in April 2013, the monograph Sorted Books by Chronicle Books, which was on the 20th anniversary of her Sorted Books project. Nina, thanks so much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
So to begin with, what is it that you're working on now, or what's happening in the studio?
Well, that's already an interesting way to set up the question, actually, because mm-hmm. I definitely have a practice that not everything happens in the studio. In fact, most things in some ways don't happen in the studio. And until only a few years ago, I really had a studio that was more like an office. And one of the effects of having a life like the one I do, I guess, and a practice like the one I have, is that a lot of the work, it's almost sort of like by definition gets made elsewhere, and is even that's almost sort of inherent to the subject matter and the methodology of many projects. And the thing that I'm most immersed in now, which is sort of a good example of this, is a project called Seed Assignment, which began 4 years ago almost, actually, on a flight when I sat down to fly from New York to Atlanta, and I thought, I have 2.5 hours of perfectly decent time in front of me, and why is it that my inclination is to think of this as time that just doesn't really count? You know, you're literally neither here nor there when you're on a plane, and somehow the headspace seems to follow, and sometimes in kind of nice ways. I think sometimes this time in between is very relaxing and freeing for all those reasons, but I also noticed that I kind of didn't take the time seriously. And I thought, what if I were to give myself the task to try to be furiously alert and furiously engaged and sort of madly creative if I could be? I mean, all the things you would want to be in the studio, what could I possibly try to bring that headspace to this next 2.5 hours? And so I didn't plan this. I just had the thought literally in my seat, and I thought, well, okay, I'll just try to make things the whole way to Atlanta. And that's what happened. I worked with what I had, and I had stuff in my bag. I had the stuff in the seat pocket in front of me. I had whatever the flight attendants passed out to snack on, and I had my camera phone. And from that point on, this project called Seed Assignment was birthed, and I've been very busy with it the last many years, because in fact lots of things happened on that first flight, and many, many things have happened since then, and it's become a very important project for me, I guess, because it tests a lot of the things that I hold dear, like, you know, is the world truly always an interesting place, or is there always more to find out there than one thinks, and what can one make out of nothing, and what can one make in circumstances when art doesn't really seem possible?
And in that case, you're actually making objects of some kind. Is that correct?
Yeah, many kinds of things happen. I mean, in some ways, although most things end up being photographs, or they end up being, you know, still pictures, there are also videos. I've also even made some sound works. But by and large, it yields photographs. But I'd say along the way to get there, there is sculpture, there's performance even of a certain sort. And it's very much a project where I construct things. I'm building little tiny things on my tray table. I'm using the pretzels that they've just passed out and crumbling them up in their little bag and then pouring them on top of a picture from the in-flight magazine to create, you know, an image that looks like a landslide, let's say. The pretzel crumbs become, you know, rubble on top of the picture of a picture of a freeway that snakes through the Appalachians or something like that. There are thousands and thousands of photographs at this point as part of this project, and over the years they've also kind of ended up grouped into categories. So there are lots of landscapes. There's a whole group called Proposals for Public Sculpture, where I try to make, again, on a very small scale, things that feel like they could be giant minimalist sculpture, sort of corporate, in front of corporate headquarters buildings, or giant works outside in fields, a little bit like, you know, at Storm King or somewhere like that. And then one of the series from this project that has had a very lively life online has been a series of self-portraits that I did in the airplane bathroom, most of them done on a very, very long flight from San Francisco to New Zealand. And in that instance, I went into the bathroom and improvised these portraits where I took what I had to work with in there, you know, toilet paper seat cover or tissue paper seat covers and paper towels or Kleenexes, and I sort of dressed myself up using these things to resemble Flemish portraits, and took these pictures then again with my cell phone handheld and tried to kind of do a, I don't know, I think of it as a curious kind of cross-dressing. I'm sort of, it's sort of time travel. I mean, you know, we're going way back in time, way back in art history, art historical time, but there's also nothing Flemish about me at all. So it's also kind of a, I sometimes joke about it as a kind of ethnic cross-dressing.
Right.
So, you know, so those pictures have had a very strange, I mean, a very strong and interesting response, I guess. They've been blogged and reblogged and written about and circulated online. There have been a few sort of, more than one by now, these sort of viral moments where they go racing around all over the internet. And that's been very curious for me. I didn't make that happen. It just kind of happened. And it poses a bit of a dilemma because they've in some ways run away from the rest of the project. And it is, I think, much more interesting if you know that they are part of something that involves a whole methodology of making things that way. So I've spent a lot of time and energy recently trying to kind of rope them back in and to say, you know, this is just one tiny slice of a much larger thing that I've been exploring for a while.
That's interesting, yeah, how the internet can kind of, you know, run with things and almost typecast you. You know, when you're talking about the seating project, that's what you call it?
Seat assignment.
And of course,
yeah.
You're photographing these. You're not gluing them down. They're not permanent artwork, so they exist as photographs. Is that right?
Yeah, they are. They're very provisional, tiny, temporary situations that then the camera, you know, freezes in time, as it were. So,
you know, it's a wonderful project. But what I keep thinking is, you know, what is it like for the person sitting next to you?
Right. I get asked that a lot. Yeah.
Here's this typical scene. It reminds me of, you know, almost that scene in Close Encounters where Richard Dreyfuss is throwing all this stuff in his living room. You know, it's like the artist as kind of, you know, nothing personal, of course, but as sort of crazy person. Like, what are you doing?
Right,
crushing up your food and playing with magazines, you know?
Right.
So,
well, here's the thing. The very thing that I'm trying not to be, which is a bored person, is exactly the thing that becomes my cover. I look like some probably kind of weird lady, but a bored lady just playing with my camera phone and trying to pass the time. And that is the reason why I have sort of staunchly stuck to using only my cell phone, because I think, for one thing, it is important that it pushes the question of sort of what can you do with only what you have, and that is a normal and natural thing for me to have on me all the time at this point, as it is for so many people. But also, you know, it helps me get away with it, and it helps it seem, in fact, rather mundane as an activity. I think that there are certainly people who probably notice I'm doing something, but I'll tell you that, you know, on 120 flights, which is I think right now that's the number of flights that I'm up to since I started this project, I've had exactly 3 people ask me questions about what I'm doing. And I think that reflects either, you know, a complete lack of curiosity or possibly sort of a I don't want to know, you know, kind of attitude about it. But I'd like to also think it's because I've managed to find ways to do a lot of things quite covertly. And you know, I guess there's even another factor to it, which is that although there's a lot of social anxiety for me, sometimes when I start making something, I mean, I do worry about, oh, God, you know, here I go again, and this is going to look weird, and what's the person next to me going to think? But once I'm sort of dug in, once I'm really absorbed in something, then there is a sort of, I mean, maybe not as dramatically as in Close Encounters, but there's a kind of, let's say, low-key mania that takes over where, you know, all you want to do is get the picture to look exactly the way you want it to. I mean, to give you a recent example, I really love the SkyMall catalog. I've been fond of the SkyMall catalog for a long time, long before this project began. And there's a wonderful picture in there of this dachshund that's trying to kind of climb up this ramp that helps them get onto a bed. I guess it's for older dogs who have trouble, like, you know, walking or getting around. And so they make these kind of dog ramps. And so there's this beautiful picture of this little dog trying to kind of get up this ramp and get onto a bed. And I spent at least an hour, maybe more, with a tiny piece of rolled up cocktail napkin, trying to create this tiny white halo to put on the dog, because when that little oval of white was on his head, it looked like some kind of, you know, ascension scene. I mean, it looked like the dog was going to heaven, and I had to get it right. I had to get it right, and the tissue kept moving, and the plane had some turbulence, and it was hard to get a sharp picture, and I just couldn't let it go until I had sort of solved it. And yeah, I don't know what the person next to me thought then. I think the other thing to point out is that often things don't look like anything unless you're seeing them through the camera. And that's another aspect to the project that I've learned a lot about, that, you know, what I construct, I'm sort of trying to construct with the camera's eye in mind. And often things that look very, very boring to the naked eye look much, much more interesting once there's the kind of flattening and you know, the shift that kind of the camera's eye brings to that. And conversely, there are also things that sometimes I think will look very interesting that look completely boring. So you kind of have to try it all.
Interesting. And I want to talk more about the sorting project and other projects and go back. But in this one that you're talking about right now with the photographs, that's also what's saleable. You're selling those images and people are buying those as your artwork, is that correct?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, photographs are fairly easy for people to get their heads around as things to buy. I mean, I make a lot of things that are, I mean, you know, it's funny for an artist. I mean, I have a lot of opportunities to show my work, which is by far the most important thing to me. I mean, I'm very grateful to have an audience. I'm very grateful to have chances to exhibit and all of that. Of course, it's also necessary and important and nice when you can, you know, make some money. But photographs are convenient that way. They're very easy for people to acquire and to kind of understand what do you do with them. You hang them on a wall. Like, it's not as challenging for most people as owning a video installation would be, although I also, you know, make and sell those too. So yeah, there have been many exhibitions of this work, and there are many more on the way. I'm working right now on something for London. A bunch of seat assignment works are going to Miami for the art fair next week, and so, you know, different kind of branches of the projects are being shown in different ways, and I'm adding to it all the time. So it's also a project that I'm never quite caught up to, and there's always more inventory. At least, you know, for now, I feel like I haven't exhausted it yet. So.
Well, I certainly love the idea of doing that on a plane. You know, there is this notion of, you know, you're flying there doing this, and it's this time taken away from a studio, and it's great to also have the sense of, you know, almost looking forward to that flight, to the show or whatever it is, because you have this, you know, very much kind of alone time, studio time, unless you're flying with other people. You know, it's this time that's very close to what people imagine is like in a big painting studio in the woods, right?
No, it's really not that, in some ways, not that different. And it really has to do with, again, it's a question of mindset. I think it's a question of how focused you are on the thing in front of you, how absorbed you are in it. And, you know, time passes very differently when one is very, very absorbed. It's a profound kind of thing, I think, that, you know, on that flight to New Zealand, it was a 14-hour flight, but I was busy the entire time, and I wasn't just making those portraits. I did a whole bunch of other things, and I got off the flight more jet-lagged than I've ever been in my life, but it flew by, so to speak. So it's funny. I was actually asked to speak a few weeks ago at a conference as part of NYU, and it was actually a psychology conference that was called Subjective Duration, and there were all these people who were speaking about time and the experience of time and what kinds of things change our perception of time, and most of them were coming at that from, you know, from the angle of a scientist or psychologist, but there were a few people like me who were speaking from other fields entirely, and I learned a very useful term that day from this German psychologist who spoke, and he spoke about this thing which is known as waiting time, which is that kind of time when you are anticipating something and waiting for something. And he said it could exist even within, like, a conversation where there's a long pause and you're sort of waiting for the person to say something, and there's a kind of anxiety around not knowing what's going to happen next. And or you could be waiting in line. I mean, we know these situations very well, but I thought to myself, seat assignment takes place, you know, entirely within the sort of terrain of waiting time. Like, that's exactly where I'm trying to be. And the studio has sometimes a similar kind of anxiety to it. You know, you're sort of hoping something good's going to happen, you know. Totally. And I'm hoping that all the time. I just happen to be on a plane when I'm hoping it, with a lot of other people around me.
Right. Let's move back a little bit. So as a child, I'd like to hear a little bit about what is it that first was an art experience for you. I mean, it's kind of such an unusual trajectory you have. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what was the first experience as art that you remember as a child? What drew you to, if you can remember, thinking that way or playing to that extent?
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes I'm asked this question at the end of like a, you know, an artist talk or something where someone says, did you always know you wanted to be an artist? And I feel like, you know, the answer everyone really wants is yes. You know, my heart began throbbing as a 3-year-old because I knew I found my calling or something like that. And it's not at all true for me. I mean, I feel like I never had intentions to become an artist. I never took an art class. I never thought about art at all until, you know, I was in college, really. I mean, I enjoyed going to museums. I enjoyed making things as a kid and drawing and all those things that most kids do. But I think what happened was the sort of light bulb moment for me was when I realized how capacious this term art really is and how many different things I was interested in really kind of fit underneath that umbrella. And first and foremost for me, I think it's kind of about an observational practice or approach or a sort of alertness to the world that then, I mean, people can bring that to lots of different kinds of fields. But what I try to do is then find a way to kind of visually present or, you know, in a number of media, which we now sort of call art media, kind of point out the things that I'm thinking about and noticing and trying to say something about to other people. And with that in mind, I guess what I learned as a kid, I think, was most importantly a kind of paying attention set of skills that I really credit to my grandparents who were Finnish, and I grew up spending a lot of time with them in Finland on a little island where my family would travel every year. And there was a lot of instruction and importance placed on looking at things in nature and, you know, learning the names of plants and birds and trees and noticing what happened and noticing how, you know, the bugs would do this thing over here with this leaf or whatever it was. And so I feel like it was I learned that from them, and it was something that was considered important and useful and good to spend time with. So I still feel like that when I go there now as an adult. It's a place where I still try to practice that, I guess. And there are projects that have come from trying to kind of get back into that mindset there. I mean, I don't know if you know my project with the mended spider webs, but that was something which I think very much grew out of those childhood experiences. I noticed there were a lot of spider webs that had holes in them, and I rather spontaneously one day decided to try to fix them using sewing thread. So went up to the house, got a little spool of red thread, went back down to the webs, and using little tweezers and scissors and things out of our sewing kit, basically, I patched up these webs. And then what happened was that the spider came back, noticed the webs had some stuff in them, and the webs actually weren't abandoned as I thought they were at all, but they threw out all my patches and fixed the web again. And we kind of got into these battles of repairing the web and a kind of human spider one-upmanship that then at that point got kind of interesting. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I would say that like what I got interested in as a child, which maybe later led to making art, was a kind of observational set of concerns.
Well, and that really is what art, you know, is, I think, in many ways about. They certainly, you know, we're taught that that's what drawing is about. It's about looking
sure.
and observing. It's not about this, you know, incredible technique. It's about
yeah.
watching. And
yeah.
understanding, and but really looking. And so you graduate school, and when was the first time you actually had a show or decided to exhibit work? How did that come about?
I guess what happened was I went to college and studied I studied literature, and I did study art. I mean, sort of in a haphazard way, I discovered it was easier to get into the art classes if you declared an art major, so I did, feeling a little bit disingenuous about it at first. But you know, then did genuinely start to get interested in art. I was at Brown University, but I was also able to take classes at the Rhode Island School of Design, and it was a nice combination of classes between those two schools, because you kind of got the rigor of the university environment in one place and then this kind of interesting, amazing laboratory of art making in the other. And so I thought by the time I finished college, I thought, I really think I am interested in this, and I think I need to spend a few years figuring out how committed I am to it. I think I'll go to graduate school. So I did that, and then by the end of those years, had really dug in, I guess, a lot more seriously. And so it was in my last year of graduate school at UC San Diego that I had my first solo show outside of a school context at a small gallery in San Diego in 1993 or something like that. Yeah.
Hmm. And how did that come about? I mean, do you remember exactly how, I mean, so you're out in the world now, you graduated from that's your graduate degree from UCSC, and what happened? There was it's an interesting where you're coming from. It's such an unusual perspective. How was it that first show happened?
These things, as they often do, I guess. It's, you know, San Diego is not a huge town, and people, they go to see work of the students in this program, and there was a local dealer who just was interested in some of the stuff I was doing, so she offered me a show. So, you know, it's sort of just, I don't know, just as things happen the same way in New York, just sort of with a bigger pool of people involved, you know. You look around, you get to know people see what you're doing, you do studio visits, it's all of that, it's all that mundane stuff. But then I had, you know, a decision to make after graduate school about where I was going to go, and I moved to San Francisco for a year thinking I would settle there. I'm from the Bay Area, and I missed Northern California, and I kind of quit making art for a year. I really just wasn't, I don't know, my head wasn't in it. I was mostly playing music, which is actually another important part of my life that has had, you know, phases when it's more front burner and phases when it's much more back burner. It at the moment is sort of in a more...
What was your instrument? What music were you playing?
I play a bunch of things, none of them particularly well, but guitar and accordion, and I grew up playing piano. Mostly I sing. I mean, I think I feel most comfortable as a singer, but I was performing in a little duo with a friend of mine. We called ourselves Grouchy Lewis, and we were writing our own material and performing quite a bit that year, but in a kind of somewhat random and reckless way, I applied to a couple of art programs in New York thinking, you know, maybe that would be interesting to do next, and then ended up getting in and ended up moving to New York, and, you know, then that was, oh my gosh, almost 17 years ago. So I kind of got pulled back towards art making then, and spent a year here in New York getting reoriented, I guess, and sort of finding that I really was still committed to this activity, and then the ball kind of got rolling. So I've been here a while now. I never thought I would have lived in this city this long. It's sort of strange to me that I did, that I have.
And then by the ball getting rolling, do you mean you got represented, or what was really happening? What does that mean for you that the ball really got rolling?
That there were opportunities to start exhibiting, and eventually that did lead to working with a gallery as well, and a couple galleries since then. But I think that it's sort of back to what I said earlier, that, you know, it's, if you have a sense of an audience, no matter, you know, that grows slowly, and but that there are people really interested and curious in what you're doing, and you have conversations that are sustaining and inspiring, and, you know, that give you ideas, like, that is so incredibly important to me. I've never really bought that line about, oh, I would make my art if no one ever looked at it. Like, I don't know about that. I know that's not true for me. I feel like it's a conversation, and it's making the work is sort of the first sentence of the conversation, or the first few paragraphs sometimes, maybe. And then it's sort of about what someone says back to you. And to me, there's sort of a life cycle that it isn't really, you know, complete or alive at all if there isn't conversation and dialogue about it. And so that may mean you show it to a couple people in your studio, or it may mean that you have a big show that a bunch of people see. But one way or another, I feel like the work is there because I want to talk about something with someone.
Well, I think that's also what museums are for, and ideally galleries are for, is the conversation. It's you know, what does this mean? What's going on? Why are we looking at this? Why is this here? Why is it important? All of those things, as, you know, as part of cultural literacy, I think, is, you know, what are we all doing here with this art stuff around us?
Right.
You know,
right.
And I guess when the conversation isn't created, when there really isn't anything, there's, you know, in many ways the art isn't functioning as it should or could.
Or people don't maybe have enough context to understand it, which I think is tricky. I mean, you know, I also teach, and I have a sort of secret mission all the time to sort of get my students more comfortable with and more interested in contemporary art, and not to kind of always feel like, oh God, I don't know what's going on, therefore I'm stupid. Like, you know, there's work that you need to know a little more about before it starts to get interesting. As with many things, I think there's sort of this curious problem with art where people sort of have some expectation they should get it right away. And that is an expectation we don't bring to many other fields. I mean, you know, I have a curator friend who has an example I really love, which is, you know, if someone took you to a baseball game and you had never heard about baseball, you wouldn't sit there sort of feeling angry that you didn't understand the baseball game right away. You would ask questions, you would figure out what the rules were, you would figure out what the players are doing, and gradually you'd sort of understand something about baseball and maybe find it interesting. And I think that sometimes art requires a bit of similar, you know, contextualization and background,
yeah,
and then it gets,
sense.
You know, gets a lot more interesting.
I think that
so.
Makes sense. You know, there is that context that's needed. I mean, you know, using that example, I have to say, you know, makes me feel less curious, because always at Thanksgiving, I'm sitting there as I was just a few days ago in front of a big screen of football.
Yeah.
Everyone's making comments on, you know, Detroit this. I know nothing about football. I have no idea what's going on. And I'm not asking any questions about what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
And I suppose I should, you know, like what does that mean? Or, you know.
Yeah.
But all I could think of is, why are those guys dancing in the end zone? And that's kind of neat. You know, I like that.
Right.
And, you know,
why are they doing that? Yeah. Yeah. When I was on that this trip to New Zealand I mentioned earlier, I was on a residency there for about 2 months, and I was taken to my first rugby game, and that was my first sports experience in a while where I really had absolutely no idea what was going on, and it was actually really fun. I mean, I kept saying, why are they lifting that guy like high up above? You know, people were very patient explaining things to me, but yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the sorting project. I mean, so you've been in New York since then and are active and teaching and continue to make art and obviously fly quite a bit. What the sorting project, the book came out based on the 20th anniversary of that project. Is that correct?
Do you mean Sorted Books? Is that the,
yeah.
the Sorted Books? Sorted Books, yeah, Sorted Books started when I was actually still in graduate school in 1993, and I never, ever imagined I would still be making these projects 20 years later. It's funny. It's one of those things where it started, and I thought it was a one-time kind of project, and now a lot of them have happened, and I imagine I'm going to be making these for the rest of my life. But the basic method of the project is the same every time I do it, which is that I go into a collection of books, and that could be a library. It could be a person's personal book collection. It could be a specialized rare book collection. And then by looking at the titles on the spines or sometimes also on the covers of the books, I arrange the books in order so that you can read the titles in sequence, and the titles are used to write with. So you end up with these sentences, stories, riddles, aphorisms, things that sometimes read like short poems or, you know, corny haiku or like all kinds of things. And I think of it as a portraiture project. I think of it as a way of trying to sum up the books that are there, both for the typical things as well as the atypical things. And certainly if I'm in a person's, an individual's library, I'm thinking of a way of reflecting them through their books too. So yeah, this book that came out with Chronicle last spring was on the 20-year anniversary of the project. That was actually just sort of a bit of good luck that the timing was such. I've been eager to do a book about the books project for a long time, and I was very happy to get to do this book with them. I just got good news this past week that I have been given permission to do a Sorted Books project in William Burroughs' personal library in Lawrence, Kansas, which is super exciting. So I'm going to be going out there to look at Burroughs' books in the next few months.
Wow,
that's
very cool. So what does that mean? So you'll go to that library, you'll reorder the books, and they'll stay that way for For how long?
No, I don't. I try not to displace. Well, yeah, this has become kind of funny. One develops methodologies over the years. But, you know, in the beginning, I would actually just start by moving books around and moved a lot of books around. And then there are a lot of books you got to put back. So I have now developed some methods where I mostly spend a few days looking and staring and writing down titles of every single book in a book collection that I think might be useful to use to you know, write with. And after a while, I mean, this is also a way of sort of memorizing a little bit what's there. And after a while, I acclimate to what's there and have learned it a little bit. And then it's possible to start composing these phrases. And I often do that by writing down book titles on index cards and then moving those around. And so, you know, it looks like some kind of project by a crazy librarian. I mean, there, you know, I often have some huge table with these note cards all over the place and lists, and I'm sort of moving and thinking, and it's very much a project where I'm kind of thinking with my hands, because you have to, I don't know, I can never do this project on a computer. It's somehow using these index cards is really important, like moving those around and seeing what goes well with what, and sometimes having two books that work great together but needing a third, and then kind of going hunting for that. And then the very last step is that I take the books off the shelf and put them in stacks. And then there's another type of editing, because sometimes that doesn't actually work out. And sometimes you think, oh, the language here was better on paper than it is once it becomes this sort of more physical thing. And so there are other adjustments that get made at that stage. And in the end, yeah, it yields a series of photographs that could range from, I don't know, like 15 or 20, or sometimes upwards of 60. Just depends what's there and how much time I have and how many books I start with.
Right, it's fascinating. And like the seat assignment work, this exists as photographs. It's almost, you know, reminds me of, you know, Andy Goldsworthy or this kind of environmental work, you know, and maybe that's a little bit about, you know, your background, but you're documenting this kind of way of working, this type of thinking, where the photograph in the end is a document of a final process.
Yeah.
But also the process itself is, it's fascinating that we don't totally understand it. It almost seems like it just came out this way, you know.
Yeah. It's not. It's interesting you say that, because actually the idea for this whole thing in some ways started way back in San Diego when I was a graduate student in the library looking for a book, and I was doing that thing that one does in libraries where you're sort of walking down the book stacks with your head slightly tilted, like reading the titles, looking for the one that you want, and I had this kind of fleeting thought of, you know, it would be so interesting if these titles accidentally became a poem. And then I thought, oh, I could just make that happen. I could just arrange them so that happens. And I think when the book, this always sounds a little bit sort of new agey and mystical, but sometimes when I'm doing this project and a really good book cluster comes out of it, it's almost this feeling like I had nothing to do with it. It's kind of strange. It's like as if the thing just kind of appeared there and the books were kind of meant to be together. And I just feel in some ways like I was just an agent, you know, in some funny way that these things now sort of are in their right place. So
that makes
it's
a lot
curious.
Of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, no, I mean, it's because it's, you know, you're writing, and at the same time you're not writing. You're using other texts, and so it's a little bit like concrete poetry. You know,
definitely.
At the same time, it's not quite that. It's not quite found poetry.
Yeah.
Because you also have, you know, all this latitude in terms of grammar and context, because we're not, you know, it's fascinating. And also that the book titles are, you know, are so weighty in a way. You know, like the title of a book. I've published a few books now, and I'm realizing that, you know, how the title book is enormously important.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's funny to be maybe a little bit less mystical and new agey about it. I think what it really means, that feeling of like the sentence almost appeared by itself, is that I guess the less my manipulation is at the forefront, and the more the sentence flows in some way that seems kind of like tremendously natural, as if it was written that way, like then, you know what I mean? Like there's sort of this, it's almost like then my involvement disappears. Like then the sentence stands on its own in a way, or the phrase that seems to you kind of forget for a moment that it was it was made to happen, you know?
Yeah.
So, but you know, with Burroughs in mind, I mean, of course, like cut up writing, and I'm so thrilled about this because his own ways of writing have something to do with the way that Sorted Books works too. And I was told tantalizingly by the people there that he has a lot of books on the occult, science, literature, travel, and cats. So I can't wait to see what he's got. So
that's fascinating. Nina, it's been really wonderful talking with you about your projects and what's going on, and I'm so excited to hear more about the Burroughs project, and envious, really. I wish I was in that library. That sounds just a fantastic experience.
Yeah, thank you. They also say there's a lot of good marginalia. He apparently scribbled a lot in his books, so I'm really grateful that they've given me. It really takes a lot of trust, I think, to let someone who you don't know in there with this important person's collection, and
But it's also a way of curating that collection, which is wonderful too, because otherwise, you know, it is this collection that's available to scholars and seems kind of heavy and academic, even if it's Burroughs, you know.
That's right. So we'll see where
it goes. So in
closing,
this is going out to young artists, older artists, a lot of different people who are looking at this in different ways. Is there anything you want to say to them in closing about, process or conversation or anything at all?
Sure. You know, one thing I've been thinking so much about this particular semester in my teaching and with my current students is that I think it's so important to take your own points of curiosity seriously. I mean, it is maybe the hardest thing to learn almost, although it should be so easy, is that the things that you really find interesting, you should indulge. You should really let yourself, you know, absolutely 120% past the point of sort of, how can I say this, you know, casual interest. We all have many, many casual interests, but I think if one can bring a kind of rigor to really thinking about why certain things are so fascinating or so interesting, that is sometimes, for me at least, a starting point for work. And I mean, one thing I'm often asked about is sort of play and playfulness, and people sometimes say, you know, there's so much humor and playfulness in your work, and can you say something about that? And I've found that it's very important to take your play seriously. So, you know, to kind of go and mess around with spiders, it seems like, you know, oh, that sounds, I mean, I could have easily thought that sounds fun, sure, but, you know, but that's that. It's just some kind of little game. But I think if you then kind of push yourself or really ask what is really going on and move things past the point of play to something that really has a kind of rigor to it, then there's a kind of, for me anyway, a kind of very useful combination in linking play with rigor and linking things that are funny with things that can be serious too. So I've been trying to encourage my own students to really take their own curiosities seriously, to really look at what they're grounded in.
Nina, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed this very much. And
thank you, me too.
I'm glad you were available.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.